This is the Skate Podcast, talking Bruins hockey with WEEI Bruins writers Scott McLaughlin, Bridget Prue, and Brian DeFelice. Lace them up for some Bees talk. It's Odyssey's The Skate Pod on WEEI. Woo!
Welcome into episode 305 of the Skate Podcast. I'm Brian DeFelice, joined by Bridget Prue and Scott McLaughlin. The Bruins and Maple Leafs are tied at one after the first two games of their best of seven series. The series now shifts northwest. Although, is Toronto actually north of Boston? I think it's just kind of west down, right?
It's probably slightly north, I think.
Is that how you're going to start now? We're going to have to look up a map, Brian?
No, yeah. Hold on. Let's get to the bottom of this.
I think it might be.
It's definitely north.
Maybe a little bit.
Like, well, north? Smidge. I always
not well north.
You'd no, be surprised. It's not super far north.
We like to be geographically
accurate. It's like Lake Winnipesaukee north.
Yeah, it's not that crazy. Regardless, the series shifts to Toronto. Now, look, the Bruins.
Now that we've pinpointed it on the map.
Now that we know exactly.
Hold on, let me get the exact latitude and longitude here.
Please, and then, you know, get back to us. Thank you. So the Bruins in game one, they deserved to win the game. They won the game. Game two, Toronto deserved to win the game. They won the game. Hats off to them. They were the better team last night. The better team last night overall. So, again, Toronto wins 3-2, series 1-1, Bridget Scott opening shifts.
Yeah, well, obviously we're going to get to the goaltending at some point. I feel like that's been my opening shift several podcasts in a row, so I'm not going to do that. My opening shift is that, you know, game one, the Bruins did a terrific job containing Austin Matthews. Lindholm-Carlo pairing, in particular, did really well in that matchup. I think it was naive for anyone to think that Matthews was going to go down quietly or not bounce back. And sure enough, game two, he took over. He dominated. Game-winning goal on a breakaway, set up the first two with primary assist on each of the Leafs' first two goals. 8 shots on goal, 6 hits, which was tied for the team lead. He played over 23 minutes, won 16 out of 23 faceoffs. Didn't really matter who the Bruins threw at him. So the Bruins, you know, now it's their turn to respond. This is what playoff series are all about, right? The Leafs answered. They bounced back. In game two, they had the answers they didn't have in game one. Now we see how the Bruins respond. And I think, you know, part of it is, yes, you have to do a better job against Matthews in particular. But also the Bruins need guys who aren't getting matched up with Austin Matthews to win their matchups. And that didn't happen in game two, which is another problem. You know, Bruins have not been very good 5-on-5 in this series. So that's another area where they have to adjust and they have to get better and they have to, just work harder than they did in game two. And we will be getting into all of that. But this is the punch counter punch of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Yep. And everyone who thought the Bruins were going to sweep after what they saw in game one might be a little bit disappointed with how things turned out. But I think most people realistically knew this was going to be a long series and that it wasn't going to be 4 games like game one for Boston. But my opening shift has to do with Andrew Peak, who left the game 6:40 left in the second period. He didn't come back for the third. Scott went back and we watched the footage of when he took his last shift on what happened, and it was on the penalty kill. He took a puck, blocked a shot with a hand on a Bertuzzi shot, and kind of seemed in discomfort right away, finished the shift, but then went down the tunnel, didn't come back. After the game, I asked Montgomery, you know, what was there an update and how hard was it to play 26 minutes with only 5 defensemen in a playoff series, and he said there was no immediate update, so hopefully today we get it, and hopefully it doesn't come like 30 minutes after I post this again.
It's probably gonna come while we're recording, so we will have updates by the time we log
we're
off,
recording
Mason Lorai is back. He's at Warrior. Steve Conroy already tweeted that, so
yeah, because we're recording pretty much right as practice is starting, so we will have the updates throughout.
It's refreshing. It's a very optional practice, so I'm not expecting too many guys to be on the ice, but
it's more about the questions about the injuries and like he said, Lauri being called up. I wrote an article that went up last night about the options that Boston has if Peak were to miss game three or any time. And obviously those include Parker Weatherspoon, who has yet to get into the playoffs yet, but has been with Boston the whole time and played regularly once he got his second call up during the regular season. Derek Forbert back off long-term IR. We can talk more, get more in depth about that and whether or not that's a good idea at this point. And then obviously Mason Lauri getting the call up, potential to maybe move him back with McAvoy. Who knows what they're planning to do. They've also kind of, I wonder if Nylander gets in the series, they do go to Lindholm McAvoy, because we can talk about that in warmups. They, and in practice, they, that's what they had. And then all of a sudden Nylander's not on the ice for warmups, and you see them start game two without that Lindholm McAvoy pair. So I wonder if it was just gamesmanship by Montgomery the whole time, or if it was, they intended on putting them back together if Nylander was playing. But anyway, my main point is the Bruins could be without Andrew Peak for game three. And if so, we can talk about who we think we want to see.
Goalie rotation. I'm in, Scotty. I'm in. I'm on board.
Come on. Don't cave that easily.
No, I'm in. I'm in. No. Look, Linus Ullmark was the Bruins' best player in game two. He was their best player. They lost, but he was their best player. There's a million reasons why they lost game two. He's not one of them. The John Tavares goal, not one of them. The Max Domi goal, not one of them. Certainly the Austin Matthews goal, not one of them. I don't know if Jeremy Swayman's making any of those saves. You know, the Janmark goal or shot that may have crossed the goal line. Was it across Yarncroke? Did it cross the goal line? Who knows? We'll never know. The Tyler Bertuzzi goal that crossed the goal line, that was a high stick, doesn't count. So those, you know, Swayman, if he was in net, I don't even know if he makes those saves. But again, of course, having a different goaltender in net isn't just a save for save when this guy made those saves. The entire game is different, is played differently. There's different rebound control. There's different plays with the puck behind the goal line, different breakouts. There's different puck stoppages. There's a ton of different things that happen. It's not just a save for save thing. That said, we'll never know. We'll never know if the goaltender who owned Toronto all year could have given the Bruins a 2-0 series lead. We won't know. What we do know is that the series is 1-1, and Linus Ullmark was the best player for the Bruins. So no matter what happens going forward, in Game 3, it's going to be Jeremy Swayman because the rotation's in play here. So if Jeremy Swayman and the Bruins lose Game 3 and Swayman gives up 5 goals, Ullmark's in Game 4. If Jeremy Swayman pitches a shutout and the Bruins win, Ullmark's in Game 4. I'm in. This is what the Bruins have done all year. This is what the goalies are used to. The Bruins are smarter than any team that's ever played in the National Hockey League because this goalie rotation is going to win them a Stanley Cup. They're so special. They're so smart. They're smarter than the game. Their fans are smarter than the game. I am serious. I'm in. The Bruins.
You are not serious. That's the most sarcastic lead up I've ever heard.
I'm dead serious. I'm serious. I'm in. This is what they've done all year. It's what I swear to God, I'm in. I'm serious. Ullmark really was awesome. He's not the reason they lost. He was great. I'm in. I think that both goalies are used to carrying the load evenly. This is what the team's used to. Ride or die by it, baby. Let's go. I'm in. Ullmark was great. Not the reason they lost. Let's talk about everything else. Not the goalies. We're good.
So you're not going to yell, are you fucking crazy at Scott today?
Nope. My only thing last episode was I wanted the Bruins to have the best chance to go up 2-0. Now that it's 1-1 and both goalies played excellent in both games, I'm in. Ride them. I don't care what happens in game three. Rotation on. And you know what? Neither should anybody else who's pro-rotation. Regardless what happens in game three, I don't care how well or poorly Swayman plays or the team plays or anything. Let's stick to this rotation just like everybody wants. Rotation. Done. I'm in. Move over. I'm on the train. I'm on. I'm on the Polar Express. Let's do it.
Wow.
Let's do it. Wow.
I really thought you were being sarcastic that whole time. I'm not going to lie.
I still think there was some sarcasm in there.
Oh, there was. When you said they're the smartest team ever, and
The Bruins, the Bruins this year and last year, they are the smartest team to ever do it. They're going to win a Stanley Cup a way nobody else has done it before. They're playing chess. Everybody else ever is playing checkers. They have two great goalies, and last year they didn't go with the rotation, and that's why they lost. We've never seen the rotation. We've never seen Jeremy Swayman get the reins for a whole series, but we've never seen the rotation. Let's do it. I know I sound like I'm being sarcastic. I'm actually on board. Seriously.
I can't shake it, but sure, I'll believe what you're telling us that you mean today.
It's so disappointing that they did end up losing, because when they were up 2-1 and Ullmark was making some pretty excellent saves in that second period before Toronto eventually tied it.
He was ready to come on here and gloat.
Oh, I was going to take the world's biggest victory lap. And you know, hey, they end up losing. So, like, I can't do that. I'm not going to do that. I do agree with everything you said, whether you're being completely genuine or not. But,
man, I was hoping we'd come back and yell at each other again.
I'm serious.
Despite ultimately taking the L, Ullmark was really good. And I think Jim Montgomery is right to not have any second guesses. My thing with the rotation has always been you use it until one of the goalies gives you a reason not to. And Ullmark certainly did not give me any reason to break the rotation. So, yeah, even if Swayman goes out and does exactly what he did in game one and, you know, 35 of 36, I'm coming back with Ullmark in game four. We can cross that bridge further after game three, depending on what happens there. I didn't pick the Bruins to win the cup. I'm not picking them to win the cup now. What I've thought is that, to me, their best chance to do that is for both goalies to be really good and for them to get excellent goaltending almost every night, right? It's not going to be they're not going to get this every single night, like for four rounds, but the majority of nights, I think that's what they need. And I think rotating is, because it's what they're used to and because neither guy has had to go on a run as a workhorse or has been able to go on a run as a workhorse, I think the best way for them to get elite goaltending night after night is to rotate and stick with what the guys know.
I wonder if we should put up a poll now that we've seen the rotation game one and game two and see how many people agree with it now and see if the numbers are different than when we first put it up.
Yeah. I think that'll be a fascinating poll to see the results of. I mean, like I'm with Jim Montgomery. Like, I have zero second guesses. You know, I certainly won't, if the Bruins lose this series, I'm never going to think about the fact that, like, you know, the guy who won the first game 5-1 got pulled in the second game, and the goalie who gave up five goals had a great game in game two. I'll never think about that. All I know is that Ullmark seriously played phenomenal in that game. Like, I don't care that the Bruins gave up a goal 11 seconds after their first goal. Like, that was a greatly timed goal, but I'm in, and I will officially succumb to the goalie rotation no matter what happens in any game. Like, let's just do it. I'm in.
I think this is your point as well, Brian. Last podcast was that wanted to see Swayman again game two, but wanted to see Ullmark game three. So we were never like anti-rotation. We just wanted it to take a little bit of like a just take stock in the fact that Swayman did what he did.
Someone commented on our last podcast though, and they're right. And like, I should jump in and correct this. Like, that's not a rotation. Like, that you can have that opinion and say you're pro using both goalies.
Yeah, but
just don't call it a rotation. Like, that's not a rotation.
Oh, well, see, to me it is. It's just not a 50-50 split.
Well, then what
I don't know.
I mean, we can get into the semantics about what's a rotation and what's not, but like, ultimately it's just, you know, I think that's just stubbornness. People just wanting every other game, because like, again, we don't need to go into the goalies for another hour. But like,
and I don't think we're going to,
we're not honestly, there's way too much other stuff to talk about, but ultimately at the end of the day, You know, I wanted the Bruins to try to go up 2-0. I didn't want the Leafs to get up, let off the hook. I wanted them to prove they could beat Swayman. You know, I was afraid of, I mean, look, I like I said, like I posed last episode, I think if you were to ask Toronto who they'd rather play in game two, I think they would have said Ullmark. I think, you know, Matthews feels good about himself. He scores. And I just thought it was good to keep Ullmark like as like a hidden ace until you needed him, until Toronto could prove that they could beat Swayman this year. And whatever, it is what it is. The Bruins, this has been their identity all year. And whether I agree with it or not, it's like, seriously, they're going to live or die by it. I question, like Scott says, he's open to, you know, using the rotation until one goalie doesn't show up. That's inevitable. So Scott's basically saying, I want the rotation until somebody sucks. And I think there's a lot of people out there that are like, no, I want the rotation completely, like no matter what. And it's just, there's never going to be a scenario where there's going to be this happy-go-lucky world of one-on, one-off. It's not going to happen. And I was just trying to get ahead of that. And like, but if people think that's honestly going to happen, like, you know, I don't know, go for it. But ultimately, they're going to live or die by it. And that's fine. That's what they've chosen.
And there's different levels to what could get me to change, right? Like, if someone's playing great and the other guy has an absolutely awful game, like 3-4 bad goals, like that could be enough. But if they're both building up good starts and then someone has only an okay game where, all right, maybe it's one or two that they weren't soft, but they could have had, like, I don't think that would get me off. Like the slightly off night after two or three good games, like that's not going to do it. It's like multiple subpar games or the one like real, real bad stinker.
The hypocrisy that annoys me throughout this, and this is kind of what it comes down to for me, is people are very disingenuous with this whole thing, because what you just said, Scott, is totally fine. And like, that's kind of more or less like where Bridget and I are coming from, right? If one goalie is playing better than the other, sure. But there are people out there that will say, like, you can't have your cake and eat it too, because some people will say, they'll reference the fact that neither goalie is used to playing back to back, and they'll reference that they're not used to riding one guy until one of those guys sucks in a game. And now what are they going to jump ship? And now it's okay. And that's what bothers me. Either stick with your argument that no matter what, both guys aren't used to carrying the load, or don't. And it annoys me that people, they cherry pick that argument when it conveniences their stance. It's like, no, don't ride one guy because they're not used to it. Oh, but if one guy slips up, then you can do it. Well, what just happened to your whole, they're not used to it. Are they still not used to it or not? And that stuff annoys me, because people like to use that argument when it's convenient for them. And that's where I'm coming from, is all.
I feel like, honestly, it's Ullmark wasn't the problem. So I feel like we don't need to spend too much time on this. And also, this is the first game of the series where we kind of think we know exactly what's going to happen in net, right? There's not a huge mystery to game three. It's Swayman. I don't think there's going to be a huge mystery to game four either. So I think we know probably the next two games what's going to happen. And then we'll reevaluate off that probably. So I actually am curious what you thought of Toronto going back to Samsonov and how he did in game two.
He was good.
He was really good.
Yeah, for sure. You know, when Toronto tied the game, and then when they went up 3-2, he made some big saves, you know, most notably probably the rebound on Marchand where he gets across, kicks out the right leg. I don't know. They won down the stretch with him in net, even though individually he wasn't playing very well. So I think it's more like, I don't know, guys are used to winning with him behind them, so they stuck with it. Joe Wall struggled since the All-Star break as well, so it's not like they had a great next up option to turn to anyways. Had Samsonov struggled or had an off night in game two, I assume they would have gone to Wall in game three. But, I think they have a lot of questions about all their goalies, but it seems like right now they feel the most confident with Samsonov. So they're going to stick with him, obviously, at least for another game, probably the next two, I would guess.
Also, real quick, I'm so pro rotation going forward. I'm ordering online a Swaymark customized Swaymark jersey. Do you guys want one, or are you guys good just for me?
See, I once again think you're kidding now. Like no. This,
are you getting the extra bedazzled gold trim on that?
Why don't you just, Brian? This is what you need. Why don't you go to a tattoo parlor, get a goalie hug tattoo, and underneath it, 2024 Stanley Cup champion.
It's already my phone case. I got that customized last night.
Right there. Just make it. I'll put it on your leg. Make it permanent.
No, honestly,
I thought full back.
Full back. Oh, that's. Brian, do you even have a tattoo?
No. But I will, because that's a great idea. all seriousness, going forward, just for the sake of the listenership and my insanity and everybody here on this podcast, going forward, I'm serious. Like, rotate. But
I'm literally gonna use AI to mock one up.
I would love one. I would love one. I think. It gives me peace of mind watching the rest of the playoffs, knowing that whatever happens, I'm just like, it's going to be a rotation. And I think that's great. So let's just see how it works. As far as last night, because Linus Ullmark seriously was the Bruins' best player last night, far and away. Toronto's goaltending was great. There was a couple goal mount scrambles where he stood strong. And then there was a 2-on-1 where Marchand, he stretched across on Marchand with the pad save. That was a really impressive stop. But I think the storyline for me, and Scott kind of mentioned off the top, was Austin Matthews showed up. Max Domi showed up and Tyler Bertuzzi. They were going. Matthews kind of pulled them along. But I felt as though 5-on-5 at even strength, I kind of want a little bit more sustainability out of the Bruins' top guys. Obviously, the Bruins had that goal in the last 7 seconds of the first period, but it was kind of a scramble and an unbelievable pass by Zacha, by the way. Aside from that goal from Pastrnak, I just feel like his presence, it hasn't been there in spades throughout the first two games, especially at even strength. And I think the same goes for Marchand.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, look, Pastrnak has 2 points in two games, both at even strength. That was an incredible pass by Zacha, but it feels like the Bruins. So if you look at 5-on-5 goals in the series so far through two games, 3-3. So you think, oh, okay, they're playing even 5-on-5. If you watch the games, you know 5-on-5 has not looked even in terms of possession, zone time, chances. And that's where, like, you dive a little deeper and it starts to look pretty lopsided. Scoring chances 5-on-5 so far, this is according to Natural Stat Trick, 58-27 Toronto. High danger chances, 25-13 Toronto. So, like, basically doubling the Bruins up in terms of legit scoring chances. That is a tough formula to win a series. Like, that, if that keeps up, that requires your goaltending to stand on its head night after night, and it requires Samsonov to fall apart at the other end. And that could happen, right? That is definitely well within the range of outcomes for this series. But you would really like to see the Bruins start to sustain more at 5-on-5. It feels like those goals, like that Pastrnak one, it takes like one-off special plays for it to happen. It's not happening by getting offensive zone shifts and cycling shift after shift and wearing the Leafs down. It's just one play. Like, Pastrnak has 2 5-on-5 shots in the series. Zacha has 2. Danton Heinen has 0. So that line had, so Pastrnak's goal came with Geeky on the ice. So if we're just going to talk about Heinen, Zacha, Pastrnak as a line, they've been outscored 2-0. They are not going up against Austin Matthews. They're getting Tavares Marner, which is obviously a tough matchup as well, but that's one like they're going to have to win or at least break even. You know, you can't lose that. So I think the Bruins' third line needs to be way better. They had that one great shift in the third period of game one. they're pretty invisible in game. You know, Geeky scores on the power play, but 5-on-5, I thought they were pretty invisible. They were getting buried in their own zone. You know, need more from Frederick. We know Jacob Lago is not an ideal third liner, but he's the one who's there. And I think he's had some good shifts. He drew another penalty, but at some point, like, you need your third line to produce offense. And at 5-on-5, they really haven't.
Well, and I'm following along with practice, and Justin Brazeau was skating today. So, I mean, that's a name that you'd probably rather have in there than Lauko if he's healthy, but still dealing with upper body injury. Montgomery will not give us an update on him.
Well, he did say the most recent time he was asked about, he said, hopefully round two, you know, again, like, yeah, you got to take everything coaches say with a whole giant container full of salt.
I mean, he could be in game, like, he could be in game three. Like, that could have been to throw us out. Like, we don't really know. Like, I don't really believe the updates, like, the, it's just be misdirection. But I think everybody would agree that that would probably be a more effective third line if Brazeau was on it than Lauko. Not that Lauko, it's not that he's playing bad for his standards. Like, this is just who he is. You know what I mean? Like, he's playing well for what he brings. I think he's played with speed. I think he's been good on the forecheck, but I just think that his skill set doesn't bring quite as much as Brazeau with his net front ability and his, how he's able to just bring pucks to the net and protect pucks and actually finish, because I did notice there was another shot by Lauko just right into the chest of Samsonov yesterday when he had a little bit of space to probably get a good shot off. So,
yeah, I feel like yesterday's game was kind of like watching the Bruins, like, without their makeup on, for lack of, like, better analogy. Like, I feel like we kind of saw, like, what they can cover up most nights, but they just, you see the deficiencies, you see the fact that Lauko is not a true third liner. Although I will say, I think he's been the most effective player on his line, but Bridget, to your point, he's effective in doing things that one should be doing on the fourth line, right? He's energetic. He's playing physical. He's getting his nose in there. I think he's the most effective player of those three right now, but he could be doing that in a fourth line role. I think that you're seeing that Danton Heinen isn't the ideal top line winger to play alongside David Pastrnak.
But I also will say, I didn't think Heinen's played poorly either in terms of doing what he does for that line, which is win puck battles, steal passes, facilitate to where the puck needs to go and get it to those guys. Cause he's obviously, it's not super surprising that he's the one that doesn't have any shots on that line, because it's kind of not his role. He picks his spots carefully when it's pretty clear that the other two guys are not options to pass to usually. So I can recall several plays where he made a good battle play to win a puck.
Yeah. My counter to that would be, it's the Stanley Cup playoffs, and just being not bad isn't good enough. Like, well, everyone's got to raise their game. And I don't mean to pick on, like, Lauko and Heinen, and because that's just not fair. Like, it's Geeky, it's Frederick, Pastrnak, right, Zacha, all of them. You know, you can throw the Martian Coil, DeBrusque line in there. At least, like, they have the built-in excuse of they're going against Austin Matthews the vast majority of their shifts. You know, you still need something from them. But, yeah, like, being okay or making some good plays isn't going to be enough. Like, they need everyone to step up and do a lot.
What I was kind of getting at, and Scott just kind of helped illustrate, is I'm not – like I said, I thought Lauko was the best player on his line. And I'm not even coming down on Danton Heinen. And what I'm saying is, when I say, what, like, it's the Bruins – you're kind of seeing who the Bruins really are up front, that they were able to cover up most of the year, is, like, you have a couple of guys that are playing too high in the lineup because you don't have, you know, the proper talent slotted where it should be because of their cap restraints. And at times against certain opponents, you'll see the fact that you'll be reminded, oh yeah, Don Sweeney had to go play Moneyball a bit, you know, and do the best he could. And that's I'm not casting blame. I'm just explaining the reality. I mean, you're looking at the Maple Leafs top two lines right now, and you know, they have more talent and William Nylander, which I think is something we can probably get into at some point because we haven't spent much time on that story. And all of Canada has. That's all they've talked about. It's been their goalie rotation story. William Nylander hasn't even played yet, right? So it's what I'm kind of getting at is I'm not blaming Danton Heinen. What I'm asking is, like, you know, is he capable at this time of year of performing at a certain level offensively? Is it too much to ask of him? Is it too much to ask of Lauko, right, to be a third line scorer? Because third lines have to score in the postseason. So that's what I noticed in game two specifically. I don't know if it's going to carry over necessarily, but the Bruins' strength, as we've talked about extensively, is certainly in net, whether you want a rotation or not. Like both goaltenders are fantastic players. And then on the blue line, now Andrew Peak goes down. That's costly, right? Because he kind of brings an element that they needed back there. So I don't know if we're done talking about the forwards because there's still probably stuff to talk about, but maybe this is a good transition to discuss what they do going forward with defensive personnel.
Yeah, and I can actually tie all this together in like an interesting wrinkle because the whole Peak going down, Forbert just coming back, I think back to the trade deadline, it's like I legitimately think the Bruins thought Derek Forbert was done for the season. I don't think this is an LTIR salary cap shenanigans type of situation, because I actually think if the Bruins knew Derek Forbert was going to be back by round one of the playoffs, I wonder, because remember, putting him on LTIR freed up $3 million. They had no cap space all season. They actually had $3 million to work with on deadline day. They used it to go get Andrew Peak because they thought, well, Forbert's gone. We need that type of player. We're missing that on our blue line. Not that they're the exact same type of player. I think Peak's more physical. So, you know, maybe they were looking for that type of player anyways. But $3 million with some of the things you can do with salary retention and all that, like, you could have landed another scorer with that money. You know, obviously you have to give up the assets to do it, but that could have been on the table. Instead, because they thought Forbert was done, they figured, well, we definitely need to address defense, so let's do that. And I can't blame them. Like, they did need to do that, and Peak's been a good addition. But it does sort of all tie together that way, where it's like, well, you know, the Bruins weren't able to add a scorer in season, and that's, you know, that's part of the reason why.
I thought where you were going with that was that Sweeney pulled a Tampa. He was trying to like bring forward
just the opposite.
Exactly. You were trying to say the opposite, but at first you were winding up, and I was like, is he gonna stay there with some cap? You know, weird situation with the cap that they were trying to pull off. And I think at the deadline we did talk a lot about where we thought the biggest need was, and though physicality was up there, I think we all thought that there were probably a middle six or top six forward shy of what they needed to be. And, you know, that may still prove to be the case. But if you want to talk about what they're going to do in game three defensively, I am very weary of going to Derek Forbert. He, even though he's come back, he's gotten two games in Providence. So obviously he's, you know, full contact in those games, and he's, you have to imagine cleared for playing with Boston. Like, he's not a healthy scratch at this point, right? This would be just a regular scratch. I mean, I should say it would be a healthy scratch at this point because he's healthy from what we know. So I'm worried to see him, how rusty that might look. And to just go right into game three like that, and jump in on a third pair with probably Shattenkirk, that's, I don't think a lot of people want to see that pair. So who is it that you would want to see, and what's the six and how they match up in your mind for game three?
Well, I think Wotherspoon's an option, right? I would go Wotherspoon, and then if somebody has to play their offside, so be it. Just because he's played so well, I think he deserves it. He earns it. As you mentioned, Forbert's rusty. And, like, I'm going to give up on the whole Lauri Grizzlick thing, because I just think it's, I think that ship has honestly sailed unless Grizzlick has a, you know, insanely poor game. I just don't think they're not going to trust Lauri, and I don't, doesn't matter if I agree with it or not. But so I guess I don't think they're going to change that. So the only change I can even think of right now is Wotherspoon going in.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Wotherspoon played well enough down the stretch where we were talking about, well, the decision between him and Shattenkirk is really just a decision about what you want in the lineup. And they opted for Shattenkirk because he brings a little more offensively. He helps on the power play, which we've seen. So now that, like, if there's an opening there, you know, we're thinking Peek's probably going to miss game three, but we don't know that for a fact. But if he does, yeah, you just put Wotherspoon in, and now you have, you know, put Wotherspoon, Shattenkirk on the third pairing, and it actually moves Shattenkirk back to his strong side. Obviously he's been playing his offside, so that seems like the most natural move. Wotherspoon was playing better than Forbert earlier this year. Now, it does have to be pointed out to people, like, a big part of the reason Forbert was struggling as much as he was is because he was dealing with two injuries that required surgery. He had two procedures done. So, you know, you gotta give him a little bit of slack there. Like, the people who are like, I don't want him anywhere near the team, he sucks. And it's like, okay, but what if the surgery to repair the two injuries he was dealing with has him feeling a lot better and allows him to play better? Like, you know, listen, we all know Forbert's not winning a Norris Trophy anytime soon, but like, let's not pretend that the injuries weren't a factor pretty much all year, because one of them, you know, I'm pretty sure it was a groin, was lingering really from training camp. Like, he missed time in the preseason, and then that was just, like, never quite right. Like, I don't want to totally make excuses for his entire season, but, you know, we're also living in reality, and, like, the guy had injuries that required two different surgeries, so let's just be realistic about that.
Yeah. And if you're losing Peek, you're losing one of your better penalty killers. And then that's a strength of Forbert. So I'm just weary.
Which we saw the importance of that last night. Because...
Oh, absolutely. As soon as Peek goes down, next penalty kill, Shattenkirk's out there and he's the guy covering Tavares, and Tavares gets the shot off. And it wasn't all Shattenkirk's fault that play was able to be made and that pass was able to be made to Tavares in the first place. But it's not the ideal situation for your penalty kill to have Shattenkirk, who very minimally plays on the penalty kill. Like, the other times I can remember him playing on the penalty kill is like when Lindholm and Carlo were both in the box. Like, you have a defenseman down or you have a defenseman in the box, like, he has to come in and play, but that's not ideal.
He played 6 minutes on the penalty kill all season.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm sure it was those kind of, like, very rare situations where there was a desperate, it was a desperate move to throw him out there because you have to, but that's not ideal. And, you know, Wotherspoon also is a decent penalty killer, not as good as Derek Forbert in his career when he's healthy. So, and back to full speed. So, but I still think that the safest move is Wotherspoon. Wotherspoon seems like a safe bet. Played more games than Forbert during the regular season at this point, which is kind of hard to believe, but because of the injury, Forbert missed a lot of time. And yeah, I think I just feel like Wotherspoon's the safest bet to go with. And he's big. He's more physical than Forbert. Doesn't block quite as many shots, but he, you know, I think he gets the job done when you put him in. So I'd feel comfortable with him coming in.
I mean, I think the reason Wotherspoon's not in the lineup is because of his play. I think it's because of the fact that Charlie McAvoy hasn't been able to properly quarterback the first power play. And so they had to move Kevin Shattenkirk and McAvoy and kind of have two different power play looks. So Shattenkirk's in there for his power play usage.
Yeah. And it's worked.
And it's worked. So,
and now McAvoy can quarterback too, because that unit's now scored 3 goals in this series. So.
Right. Right. So that's why Wotherspoon's been out. Right. It wasn't because he was outperformed at what he's been asked to do. It's that there were other needs that, you know, he was the casualty of it. Now, has there been a update on Peek besides the fact that he's not taking the optional skate this morning?
Not quite. Not yet. I think we're probably looking at another like 10 minutes or so from now. But what I did see was Ty Anderson just tweeted there's 9 players, both goalies are out there: Lauri, Weatherspoon, Forbert, Boqvist, Lauko, Frederick, JVR, and Brezzo. So these are none of
the... It's the scratches and like the bottom six, basically.
Yep. And and guys that are trying to get healthy, trying to, you know, get back in there, like Forbert and Brezzo.
So
I don't think there's a lot to read into it, honestly.
No, definitely not.
So I know this is not TSN or Sportsnet or a Maple Leafs podcast, but I do think we should talk about William Nylander.
One day, Brian, we'll have our own TSN show. One day.
What is going on with William Nylander? He's been playing, he's been skating in practice and optional skates and whatnot. It plays all 82 games. Playoffs, as we know, it's like these guys, unless their leg is falling off, like they're playing, he's skating, he seems to be moving well. Do you guys buy into the fact that he was going for a joy skate at the end of the season, so Sheldon Keefe is sending a message, or is it a legitimate illness or injury that you think is holding him out of the lineup?
I thought it was just to throw people off the scent. Like, I thought it was just a gamesmanship thing. Like, throw him out there. Obviously, there's benefit for him feeling out whatever injury he's dealing with and seeing how he feels. But like, it also, I mean, I'm sure Toronto media was going crazy. Oh, Nylander's on the ice. You know, like he skated this morning. Like and then I think it actually did change the way Montgomery was going to use the Bruins D pairs. And then as soon as he sees Nylander not on the ice for warmups, he goes back to what he was planning on doing and did in game one.
I think on home ice, the plan was always going to be Lindholm, Carlo against the Matthews line.
Do you think that was gamesmanship too? Or do you think that they would have wanted?
Yeah, I think coaches get very silly this time of year and you just can't read too much into anything. Nylander's fascinating, right? He plays all 82 games. He plays all the way to the end of their regular season finale. Like, he didn't leave that game early. And then he just isn't at their first practice on the Friday before game one. Obviously doesn't play, didn't take warm-ups. Then he's on the ice, but like, if you watch the videos, I think Chris Johnston tweeted some of them. That like the first couple he tweets, it's like, oh my God, this guy can't skate. Like, whatever he's dealing with is serious. Like, he could like barely move. He's like whiffing on shots. And it's like, what the hell did he do? And then he's out there 50 minutes and like, it looks like he starts to loosen up and all of a sudden he looks okay. Then he takes part in morning skate, but he's not doing line rushes. So obviously it, to me, just kind of piecing things together, it seems like a back injury. Like, they said he woke up with something. That's been the reports, is that the morning after the regular season finale, he woke up not feeling good. And then like, when you look at him skating, it's like you could see that being a back thing that causes all that stiffness and the way he's kind of like hunched over a little bit. And you know, so it could be something that just like has to loosen up, that he has to work through. It reminds me of last year when we were trying to decipher all the Bergeron videos when he was at Warrior skating
and
on
that
his
was
own,
a back right? injury
right which we didn't know for a fact at the time, but found out afterwards was a herniated disc in his back. So it feels like something similar to that.
That's a good educated guess, Scott, because there's no way. Look, everybody saw this viral video that went around of Nylander just seriously not even skating or trying in game 82 against Tampa and like leading to a Tampa Bay breakaway goal. And if he was dealing with a back issue, that could honestly explain why he was just like, fuck, you know, screw this for right now. And again, like, Sheldon Keefe is not sending a 2-game message to one of his best players right. against the Boston Bruins when every game obviously is vital. So I think, back issues are things to not be, you know, treated with irresponsibly. And I think that's a good, it's interesting because for the last couple of days, I've been listening to different, you know, clips from the talking heads in Canada and Toronto. And it's not once did I even hear the possibility of a back issue. So it's like, go to Scott for the reason, because, or go to Scott for like to hear a legitimate potential reason. All you hear in those talking heads is like message sending conspiracies or what is it? And yeah, it actually very well probably is a back issue. You're right.
It feels like, I don't know how they turned on him as quickly as they did, but it felt like they, because they turned on him, they weren't logically like looking at, I don't know, at least some of Razor's friends sounded like they were, they sound like they wanted him to play through it, whatever it is, which if you can't play well, then like, why would you want that guy out on the ice? He's not himself, you know? Yeah, they're like, oh, you know, hockey players, they play through everything. Like, look at Patrice Bergeron. He played with broken ribs and a punctured lung, and Chara play with a broken jaw and blah, blah, blah. Like, if you can't skate right, you're going to hurt the team rather than do anything to help it. So it doesn't make sense to me. Maybe we're only hearing the silliness of it. I'm sure it's like our dealing with Boston sports media and Boston fans that listen to certain stations and they have their own conspiracies that we're like, that's crazy. So I'm sure it's just a little bit of that as well.
Mm. Right. And even as tough as we all know, Patrice Bergeron is, like, he had a back issue last year. He missed 4 playoff games. So, you know, but who knows? Like, maybe he could have just been really sick. Like, it's, there's so many things, but yeah, I find it, I'm with you, Bridget, like the people who are like, he just needs to be in there, like no matter what. And it's like, I don't know how you can say that without knowing what it is. Like,
nope.
That's, you know, in the past, William Nylander's been like the one member of that core four who usually shows up in the playoffs and steps up and plays well. Like he's kind of been the one that's gotten the least amount of criticism this time of year. It's been more Matthews, Marner, Tavares. So he doesn't strike me as a guy who doesn't want to be out there or doesn't want to battle or whatever. Like that doesn't really seem like, to me, doesn't seem like the type of player he is, but I don't, maybe there's people up in Toronto who are starting to think that, I guess.
Yeah. Well, there's also people that think Pasta doesn't care and doesn't try either. So I don't know. That maybe we're just talking to, hopefully we gotta get Razor. I gotta ask Razor again. He knows better than us what it's actually like going on up there right now. But by the way, Bruins officially just recalled Lori, so they announced it that, but we already obviously knew he was practicing, but it's okay. Official now, just to put that out there.
So looking ahead to game 3, Bridget and Scott, we know who the goaltender is going to be starting. We know based off of our commentary off the top that the Bruins struggled to generate much offense at 5-on-5, in particular their top players, right? So the obvious, what can they do better in game 3 is to generate more 5-on-5 opportunities. The question is, Bridget and Scott, how do they do that?
Well, it's interesting because I thought for sure Sheldon Keefe was going to make some lineup changes for game 2. Usually most coaches do after a loss in the playoffs, at least one or two here and there, whether it's, you know, someone comes in for someone or you switch up a line. Keefe rolled out the same exact lineup, and it felt like his approach was, I'm just going to trust my best players to bounce back after a tough game 1. And they did. Austin Matthews in particular, but also Bertuzzi, Domi, Tavares scores a big goal, like that they all did. So, you know, we know Jim Montgomery loves changing up lines, and maybe there's something like that. But I kind of feel like if I were Montgomery, I would issue the same challenge to my players that I think Sheldon Keefe just did to his top players, is, guys, like I'm keeping it together. I think what we have works. You got to step up. Like we just need more from everyone. And then it's, I guess like in terms of like X's and O's, it's a lot of stuff we've talked about all year. It's like the Bruins have to hold on to pucks more in the offensive zone. They have to transition cleaner. I want to see them. We've talked about this on Sunday, skate quite a bit because Razor always brings it up, but simplify the breakout. I mean, how many times last night trying to get out of their own zone. They're looking for passes that don't connect, end up getting kept in the zone. And it's like, listen, that's great when it's there. You know, clean breakout passes lead to better transition, and you need better transition, so I get it.
And they had a really hard time transitioning in the last like 3 or 4 minutes. They're trying to pull Ullmark. He kept having to go back, and like they had such a hard time trying to tie it up when it was 3-2 transitioning that they didn't get into the offensive zone really at all. And they had to delay pulling Ullmark and everything.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a situation where you do have to force the passes, right? Like you're not chipping glass in that when you're down by a goal. Mm-hmm. But I mean, more like earlier in the game, they had so many times they just could not get out of their zone because passes weren't connecting. And it's like, just go. Well, I'm catching myself because I'm like, just go off the glass and out. Well, Amazon tried to do that and led to a goal because of the stupid stanchion, which, by the way, total aside, but like, they got to fix the friggin' glass at TD Garden after the season. Like, clearly it's a lost cause at this point, but
Razor,
I cannot ever remember seeing so many bizarre bounces off glass.
It's bad.
As
it's
we've really seen at bad. TD Garden this season. Like, it's to the point where it's like, oh, it's not just like a little funky thing where it happens a little more at this arena. It's like, no, like this is like legitimately bad. Like something's like actually wrong with the way they're putting the glass together or whatever.
Or like maybe there's like a newer, better way to like seal, you know, everything straight to it. I don't know. I'm not the person.
I think my guess is they're going to completely replace all the boards and glass.
That would be honestly probably the only way to fix it. Yeah. But Razor has talked about, he's like, if you're a goalie playing at TD Garden, you know, you can't come out to play the puck in certain areas because you'll see it. Someone will rim it around. And instead of you go behind your net to kind of like stop the puck, but instead before it gets behind the net, it hits something, it popped right back out in front. There's no one in net. Like you've seen that happen and almost bite, you know, sometimes it's the Bruins goaltending. Sometimes it's the other team's goaltending. He's like, basically as a goalie, you have to be really careful playing the puck because randomly it'll pop back out. And we've seen that a bunch. And that happened for the, not that long ago, Tkachuk scored a goal off of something like that, where the puck was rimming and didn't go all the way around, pop back out right to Tkachuk. So, it leads to goals. It's one of those random things where people say, oh, you know, you got to get the right bounces. Well, that's one of those situations where that's just a random bounce and you get it or you don't.
You know, it's interesting, in Boston, we romanticize and we cherish the old Boston Garden for its character. And Bridget, you and I are too young to remember. I may have been to a game there when I was very, very young, but I don't remember. I think Scott has very vague memories, but.
I went to exactly one game there the last season.
Now people will mention how it was a train wreck of a building as far as amenities and blah, 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 all that stuff. But as far as character and you know, it was a cathedral, right? Well, it's interesting because the modern day TD Garden is already, you know, 25, 26 years later, one of the older active buildings in the NHL.
I think it's 28, 29. Yeah. It's almost 30 now.
Yeah.
So that's probably why I would never have gone.
It's one of the older active buildings used in the NHL, which is interesting because I think in Boston we kind of still view it as like a teenager with the old garden that preceded it. But when I go to the garden, you guys talk about the stanchions and the boards. If you go to the garden right now, you look at the ice, and I look at the ice and I say to myself, oh, that looks so beautiful, right? It's like NHL ice always looks so beautiful. But if you listen to players, Bruins players around the league, no disrespect to the TD Garden crew, they can only control so much, right? It's the systems in place, but people, players will say that the garden has some of the worst ice in the league. And I feel like you notice that sometimes, like there's a lot of pucks hopping over sticks on power plays and stuff that you don't normally see with star players on both sides, Bruins players and opposing players. So maybe the garden, they spent what, billions, doing the outside of Causeway Street and, you know,
There's legitimately like a whole tower on top of the garden now.
There's an assembly row around Boston Garden now. Maybe they should.
There's a venue. There's a music venue underneath it.
Maybe they should invest some of that money into the rinks facilities, like the ice, the boards, and the glass.
I think they did redo the entire refrigeration system within the last couple of years. So
okay,
hopefully it's at least somewhat better. I honestly haven't even really talked to guys about it, but I do think I remember them replacing it not that long ago. But yeah, it did used to be much worse. Like, and you would see it in some playoff games, like in the spring, especially like when it would start to get warmer, like
right now.
Yeah. Like you'd see time. Well,
yeah.
Can it please start getting warmer? That'd be very nice.
Well, oftentimes they individuals will cite the fact that there's so much turnover between Celtics games and Bruins games, and that it's not great for, you know, the ice or whatever. But, you know, the Bruins are far from the only team in the league that has that similar schedule with teams sharing buildings and whatnot. So, but
the other day there was a million things in the hallway from a Nicki Minaj concert. Like, they're also turning over concerts and stuff. And there was just, our whole hallway to the media area was just full of stuff that said, do not touch Nicki Minaj, like, equipment. And yeah, it was just another reminder that things are constantly changing there when we're not seeing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That reminds me, I stole one of her outfits. I forgot to wear it for the podcast.
Oh, no. Which one? Is it the bedazzled bra?
Oh my god, please, that's not an image I need.
That's your other tattoo, other leg.
Yeah exactly. All right, well, we're approaching an hour, guys. We've probably covered, if not everything, close to everything, I think, to an extent. So if there's anything else you guys have, I guess let's go over it now before we sign off.
One last check of the updates. Because obviously,
yeah, I don't think Montgomery's spoken yet. So mm-mm. we're gonna log off, and he's gonna announce that Andrew Peak lost a finger, and he's gonna play with four fingers.
Well, you have to imagine he's gonna play still. Okay, that's interesting. You have to imagine he had to have gone for imaging, right? Like he had to have gone for an X-ray.
Monty's gonna be like, is Andrew Peak playing in the lineup? Well, I'll tell you this. He has the same amount of vowels in his name as he has fingers. Okay, Monty. Thank you.
Three. No.
This thing on. Okay. Thank you very much. Very funny.
No. Yeah. No. His Wordle. Wordle question.
Okay. Anything else, guys?
I don't think so. Just, you know, I know everyone gets like worked up this time of year. This is one of my favorite parts of the playoffs, though, is just the yo-yoing from like we're on top of the world to sky's falling and everything sucks. And it's like you just saw it through two games where it completely flipped for both of these teams. So, you know, look, we covered a lot of negatives because they lost. They lost game two. But, you know, doesn't mean the series is over. Clearly things the Bruins have to improve. But it can all swing back in their direction so quickly. So we'll see Wednesday night.
Well, and when you, if you think about it, like, I don't know if you guys like tennis, but I play tennis. I like tennis. You got to break serve, right? If you're the team that's not the home, if you don't have home ice advantage, you got to break serve, which means in order to win a series, you have to win at least, you know, one game on the road. Cause you only got three home games and Toronto broke serve. So, basically, now the advantage goes back to them, right? In terms of home ice, and then, you know, if you're the Bruins, then now you got to break back, and you're gonna have to steal one in Toronto in either games three or four.
And the Bruins play well in Toronto; they always have. So, I mean, ultimately, it's gonna be one of those series where, one way, shape, or form, it's probably going to come back to Boston for game 5-2-2. It's how it goes with these two teams, and it's going to be a best of three. But, you know, time will tell. I think just to wrap things up, I think, you know, Scott and I, people are getting all get hot and bothered. All Bridget and Scott or Brian, Bridget and Brian are bullying. No, we're not bullying anybody.
I don't think anyone said that. People, there were some funny comments on our last YouTube, though.
No, I don't know. Somebody accused me of bullying Scott. I'm like, I'm not bullying Scott. I told, like I said,
on Twitter. Is that one on Twitter?
No, it was on. It was on the comments. But look, if they're, I'm the first one into the scrum to face wash and jersey jab. If anybody slashes Scott in the back of the leg, Scott knows that. It's all fun and games. No one's mad at anybody.
And you would. Who am I in this situation? Probably the person that slashed him in the back.
You're the ref. Call me for instigating.
I think Bruins PR listened to our episode. I think they knew how heated things got because they had me and Bridget separate in the press box.
They actually did. Right? And you want to know what they really didn't know?
Yeah.
So on the sheet, it said we were supposed to be next to each other, but someone put Scott. Moved the name tags in the wrong spot, and I think Scott just beat me up there, switched it around, put me next to Bell, put two people in between us so he didn't have to deal with me. But I did show him the comment.
I can't believe I didn't think of it early in the season, you know, like,
yeah, next time I'm moving back,
like,
you know?
Here I was thinking like they're assigned seats, and now I'm like, you know what, I can just move these little placards wherever I want.
You know what, I like sitting next to Bell better anyway, so
fine, great. Stay over there.
Wait till the day.
I promise I didn't write this tweet on this comment that said Scott was annoying.
That was me, actually.
Your burner.
I can't wait for the day where Scott just takes the elevator up to the ninth floor and he looks over at his seat and he's sandwiched between me and Bridget on the ninth floor. Mm-hmm. I make my debut after like 4 years of being involved at EEI. I go up to the ninth floor for the first time.
Yep. One day.
I remember in 2021 when they played the Islanders, I asked, I talked to Scott about like how to get practice access. Although I'm pretty sure you can go to like Bruins practices for free, like to the public, but regardless.
Yeah. When they're at Warrior, they're open to the public.
Yeah. So here I am thinking Scott's doing me this big favor of getting me practice access. I'm pretty sure anybody can go. But
I think I did get you press box access. That's not open to the public.
Yeah.
Can't just wander up.
You can't just walk into the locker room.
You know what though? It wasn't because it was here's what it was. It was closed off because it was during COVID. So I do think access was limited. You had to get but anyway, so I went to my first practice in the playoffs, and then the next game they got eliminated. I've never asked for privileges again. I'm like, maybe I'm not meant to be around these guys asking them the hard questions, but in any event, okay, that probably wraps it up. We have game three is Wednesday. Is it every other night?
Wednesday night. The big breaks between, so they have a break between 3 and 4 and then between 4 and 5. They go Wednesday, Saturday, Tuesday. So it starts to stretch out a little bit in the middle of the series. I think that's because it's all the networks. They just want this series like on their best nights. So, you know, like ESPN wants this game Wednesday night because they don't want it going up against the NFL draft Thursday night. But then Hockey Night Canada wants it Saturday. So it's making all the TV partners happy.
Yep. And I'm very aware of why the schedule is the way it is with you know, my other job. We're trying to figure out the best times to get to as many people as we possibly can. So this is a series that every network wanted. They didn't. Yeah. I doubt they wanted Bruins Tampa over this. This is a big one.
So as far as the podcast release schedule, obviously throughout the year, you guys grew accustomed to Monday, Wednesday, Friday releases. I would just go under the assumption going forward, day after a playoff game, especially if it's a night playoff game, just, you know, expect an episode the following morning. That's pretty much how we're going to go about this. And, you know, this is no different. So expect next episode probably Thursday morning.
Yeah. With, I would say the Saturday into Sunday, a little different because obviously Bridget and I will be on Sunday skate on WEI Sunday morning. So probably the next episode after that, it's going to be dropped Monday morning, I would guess, right?
Sure.
Yeah. But we're still going to put up Sunday skate. I post that almost like it usually pops up probably about an hour after the show because it takes me a little bit to cut it and stuff. But yeah, that'll be there too.
All right. That'll wrap it up. 1-1 series going to Toronto. Pro goalie rotation. Let's bring it home. Let's do it, right? And we'll talk to you all after game 3. Thanks for listening.